Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You're listening to The Sound of London. This is Londonist Out Loud. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe, and sometimes things just resonate when set next to each other. Last week's episode and this week's are doing exactly that. And once you've heard the both of them, you'll understand exactly what I'm talking about. I have a feeling as well that a thank you is overdue from last week's show to Larry Porges, who got the ball rolling in no small way, and to Moscow London on Twitter, who fanned the flames. Nico Epstein of ArtTuner was instrumental in getting things going this week as well. And by the way, you can read my guest Ava Mack's account of the show on ArtTuner. Get to arttuner.com and dig out the Best Kept Secrets Finale Ben Uri Gallery Museum is the name of that link. I don't often have to do this, but there is some material in this episode that, if it were heard by the younger ear, might provoke questions. It would be pretty hard to answer without causing upset. So just a warning that things turn particularly dark around about the midway point. On a warmer and cuddlier note, hello to Twitter users Donna Deeble, Blonde Girlfriend, Amy Bjorklund and Sherbert. Some beautiful thoughts from most of you. I really appreciate those. Amy, who's a keen listener in the US, wants to know whether she doesn't have iTunes, there's another platform that people would recommend. And it made me wonder what you're listening to this show on. There is Acast, of course, which we use on the website and on which you can look at various illustrative material of each episode. But what is your podcast platform of choice? It would be interesting to know. In particular, what would you suggest Amy should use? At Sherbert is very keen to hear a history of the London taxi and its cabbies. That sounds like a superb idea to me. And listener, if you know of somebody who might be able to provide exactly that, do drop me a line or just tweet to say hello. At Londonist Sound is the Twitter handle you need, or you can find me at N. Quentin Wolfe. 10 bonus points to you if you can guess the correct answer to this one. In the 1930s, whereabouts in London do you think an Aberdonian farmer regularly grazed his sheep?
Hey baby, let me take you down to a place of strange sights and sounds you ain't never seen the light before. Just a stone's throw from your front door. Baby, stood out me, see me to the air, land and sea. Some creep, some saw down the road, jam rag store.
My heart aches for some far off place. No one cutters their view with your name, how you raised us.
We're in Northwest London, surrounded by echoey space and walls and pictures which reflect sound just beautifully, so you'll hear us coming back at ourselves. Us, in this case, being Ava Mack, who is a writer for ArtTuner, and Katie Harris, the learning manager at the Ben Uri. G'day.
Hello.
Hello.
We've been trying to find out some interesting facts about the area. I should say everybody here is new, or new in job, so this could be a learning experience for everybody. We are at the Ben Uri, and interesting facts about the area around the Ben Uri. What have we dug up, Ava?
That Saatchi Gallery used to be here.
Yep, in 1985 it was on this very road.
Do we know where? No.
We don't.
Somewhere in the vicinity. And the vicinity is affluent.
I think so. I think some records for house prices around this area.
Did I hear it's the third most affluent place in the country or something?
Let's go with that claim. Let's do it.
In the post-fact era, this is good information. We are here to, of course, talk about the work of the Ben Uri and also to look at the collections that we can see on here. If you want to come down and have a look at what's here, you need to be fast because we are recording at a time of changeover. We're just at the tail end of one exhibition and the start of another, and we'll talk some more about what we can see here. Actually, it ties in rather well with other things we've been talking about on the podcast recently. Art Tuner, though, is probably a good place to start. Ava, tell us more.
So Art Tuner is a contemporary art platform that tries to engage collectors and bring contemporary art from all over the world to London. But what is interesting is that it doesn't have a physical space, so it exists online. And there's a magazine, and there's interviews with artists, and there is online art curations founded by Eugenio Re Ribadengo in 2013. He comes from an Italian family of collectors, and he came to London thinking that he was going to do things differently to the more traditional contemporary art galleries in Mayfair that are all very, I guess, fancy and maybe a bit intimidating. So Art Tuner tries to open up and bring contemporary art and what's going on with that to a collector's public.
Now, is this just a case of slapping the pictures up online, or is there a little more to it than that?
So they definitely also put art up in physical spaces, but I guess in a very agile way, can choose where to go, can dig out local spaces in South London. For example, they did a project called Studio Escape, where they engaged with South London artists and had them do tours of their studio and then bring all the works together in an exhibition that was physically mounted. Equally, now they're in New York, and there's going to be a show there in Chelsea in a gallery that will be in a physical space as well, but it's always complemented by the online curation.
I'm with you. So this is the next generation. It used to be, didn't it, maybe 10 years ago, that if you were a gallery, you'd have your name and address online and a little notice saying what was being exhibited, and that was about all you'd do. And this sounds like a better interface.
Well, yeah, it's definitely trying to move towards finding new models for contemporary art in the 21st century.
Katie Harris, you are new in post. You've been here a month.
Yes, about a month, yes.
How's it going so far?
Yeah, it's good. Busy. Very busy. I'm enjoying it a lot, though. There's so much going on here that the learning programme is so expansive. Like, the schools visits, wellbeing programme, online resources. There's just so much to do, as well as exhibitions. So it's always exciting.
There's something about the size and the space that we should probably tackle in connection with that, really, because you're coming from a much bigger museum situation in your previous work. And this place is about the size of a shop unit here on Boundary Road. On the one hand, it must be a bit of a culture shock coming to a very different sort of environment, I presume. On the other hand, it sounds like there's a hell of a lot going on.
Yeah, well, the space is challenging. We have, obviously, in our collection, we've got basically a national collection. There's over 1,300 works.
But which I should say is not obvious from the modest presentation the outside of the building, and indeed the slender interior.
Yeah, we've got, there's obviously lots of it's in storage. We can't have it all out on display, which is such a shame, because there's such a wealth of artists' work that we could display. And we just recently had our centenary, which was Christie's and Somerset House. We're able to display so much more of the works, and you know, that was a great opportunity to really get some support going and engagement, because we can't have it all on display at the same time here in the gallery, which is a shame, which is why we're looking and we need support for a larger location in central London, so that we can make our collection as accessible as possible to the widest possible audience.
We were in the delicious situation earlier on of debating about who or what Ben Urey was. And Ava, you know the answer.
So I think we established that a Jewish emigre artist or art enthusiast from Eastern Europe came to London in the early 20th century and established an art society for the kind of outsider community in the Jewish ghetto in Whitechapel.
Yeah.
And then from there, it's built, and obviously 100 years on, there's 1,300 works that...
Did you say outsider art?
I guess outsider art, emigre art. So the whole collection is made up of artists who, I guess, were displaced and went somewhere else, obviously a Jewish identity. Mm-hmm. And London is, I guess, such a great place for displaying that kind of collection. But in terms of digital resources, the whole Ben Urey collection is accessible online, isn't it? I don't know whether that was for the centenary that was kind of completed, but I had a look and it looks really impressive to have all that online.
Yeah, it's great because you can really see clearly which countries they've come from.
Yeah.
We also have a very large percentage of female artists. We have, you know, such a range of emigre artists here.
35 countries.
Yeah, 35 countries, yes. Yeah,
and so. All Jewish or...?
Not all Jewish, no. I mean, it's immigrant communities that are moving to London or moving across different countries. So we're basically a platform for anyone that wants to link to migration. I mean, art, identity and migration are the themes that run through everything we do.
Right. So when I was asking about outsider art, I was thinking of that school of art of people who have not been educated in art and they produce. But no, we're talking about people who come from outside somewhere and have to deal with London as foreigners.
Yeah, and I think you can see that in our current exhibition, actually, that these photographs that we're going to talk about are actually, it's through the eyes of someone who's migrated to a country, so or to a city, like Wolf Sosicki, who's come to London from Vienna, and it's what they perceive, which other people just can't, who are living there, who are permanent residents.
Was this exhibition in place when you arrived?
It was, yes.
Okay, so you walk through the door, you spend a little time with it. As we know, when you spend time with any collection of art or music, the things that jump out at you early on aren't necessarily the ones that have the most profound effect on you. They're not necessarily the ones you go back to.
It's true.
Which pieces here are the ones that have grown on you?
For me, there's a photograph by Dorothy Bum, and she's taking this photo of two small children, a boy and a girl. And initially, I suppose, it's one that you look at and it's quite curious because the children are looking off into the distance. And when you start to look a bit closely at it, you can see just how closely Dorothy's managed to get. And we were having this discussion earlier about how, as a female photographer, she's able to be very inconspicuous as opposed to, you know, perhaps the men in the male photographers. She's able to get that closeness and they don't notice her. She's inconspicuous to her completely. And when you look for more detail, you can see the little boy is holding onto her, the little girl's shoulder, grabbing her cardigan. And there's a sense of protection, but not from the photographer, from something that's off frame. And that's what's quite curious, is that you then want to know what's going on off frame. And she's captured that moment beautifully.
Well, that's a Montmartre. And can we guess what he's got in the bottle there? It's got one of those Grolsch style cups on it, but that doesn't necessarily mean
it's like a huge bottle of beer, but I'm sure it wasn't.
You think he's out on the town?
But Dorothy's photography was taking place in Paris, and it's quite an interesting one, I think, for me.
What about Ava? Your first experience of this collection is as a reviewer, or?
Yeah, so I review exhibitions on a different kind of lesser known contemporary art or modern art spaces in London, and I very much come in and have a look and presume that the people that I write for are going to be surprised as well by what they see, and so I definitely try to kind of come at it with a fresh perspective.
So which piece on this level would you suggest would hold the most surprise?
I think the Wolf Sosicki's pictures of London, most of which are of Charing Cross Road, are very, really stand out to me, because I'm not originally a Londoner, but I guess most people that come to London very quickly feel that they're part of London, because I mean, everyone comes from everywhere, and it's those kind of fresh eyes looking at Charing Cross Road, for example, the milkman here pushing his little cart along in 1930s London, obviously an area that is now completely different, but it really captures the spirit of the time. It's obviously raining. I think in his photographs there's a real sense of admiration of the kind of the local trade that took place on that road, and the I don't know, the daily grind, but very, very affectionate photographs, I think.
And they're incredibly sharp as well, aren't they? You forget, because you see so many studio shots of the time, you forget that street photography is possible, and to get these sort of fly-on-the-wall type shots. In the one in front of us here, we've got the milkman with his cart. He's handing out the weekly milk bill to somebody who's got a fox stole and a piper hat.
A lot of these shots are, especially for Wolf Sosicki, they really evoke a sense of narrative, don't they? And he was a cameraman for lots of famous pictures later in his life. And I think how old is he now?
Well, he'll be if he doesn't mind me saying, 104.
I should think he'd be delighted.
In August. I mean, all of the photographers are still current, and they are still, some of them are still taking photos. But Wolf is, you know, born in 1912. He's lived through 2 world wars, and his photographs as well are, you know, time capsules in themselves. They really reflect that period and what was going on and all the changes that were happening.
That bus on Cambridge Circus, I guess that bus still, you know, looks like it does now. It's not that yeah. different.
There's something that makes me want to weep here, though, because 1936 and 37 are the dates on most of these pictures, and of course we know what's just around the corner for London, and downstairs I think we're going to see something of that.
Yes, and that's what's great about them, is that we know the timeline, we know what's going to happen, but these are, you know, reflecting just those pre-moments before war started. And they're great for working with the children that come in, family visits, because you can really, you know, show them how different life was. And we do have a current, actually, street photography competition going on, so we're encouraging young people to actually take inspiration from these and get involved and do their own London sites and see what they can find.
So has Wolf been in here?
Yes, he has, and hopefully he will be in again, but yeah, they've all popped in. I think possibly Neil Libbett might not have, but yeah.
What did he make of the exhibition, do we know?
I think they were all very pleased, but I wasn't there, but I'm sure they were all very pleased. I'm sure they would say if they weren't as well.
That's interesting. I wonder if you can imagine what it would be like to have your work still being displayed and talked about and used as an exemplar of something 50, 60, 70, 80 years on.
Yeah, we do have a conversation with Dorothy Bone coming up on the 4th of August. It is sold out, unfortunately, but, you know, she will be discussing her work, and it's a privilege that she's able to do that. So, you know, might find out some more.
You find out what those children were looking at.
Yeah, and we're going to be recording it, hopefully, so we can upload it to our website.
Great.
So, yeah.
So, should we talk a little bit more about the Ben Urey then, in terms of its trajectory and its direction now? Where's it trying to get to? Where's it coming from?
Well, the future...
That's everything.
Well, the future is...
Now, let's do the past first. What's it been? What sort of different forms has it taken? Has it always been here? Has it evolved? What's been going on?
Well, it started off as an art society near Whitechapel, and it's taken on many different changes. At one point, they were based in Soho in Dean Street. It's nearly faced closure before moving to St John's. And it's changed in terms of, I suppose, what it collects. I mean, originally we were focusing on Jewish artists, but it's evolving much more to reflect all artists that have migrated, and that's really where we're going. We want to be sort of, we are the, if you like, the only specialist art museum in Europe addressing...
This is very smoothly done. I don't think anybody's going to spot the joy in that.
Addressing our universal and ever more central issues of identity and migration, which obviously are very, very topical subjects, particularly in the current climate.
So yeah, very much so.
It's, I'm very proud to work for a museum that actually focuses on those three themes and gives a platform for those... for different communities.
It might be worth nailing that down a little bit. We'll talk about the future of the Ben Urey as we go. The immigration debate hasn't reflected a particularly positive general view amongst people, particularly outside of London. The majority view, I think, could be seen as anti-immigration, whether you consider that viewpoint to be based on rational concerns or various phobias. Mm-hmm. What are you doing here to deal with those sorts of issues?
We're just carrying on, really. I mean, we're just promoting as much as possible, working in the community with, for example, there was an estate across the Ainsworth and Alexander estate across the road. We set up community partnerships so that, you know, local communities know that Ben Urey is very much an accessible collection that is promoting art identity and migration, and that these issues are very important, and regardless of political or changes that are going on around us. That's our mission, that's our view. We want to be, you know, accessible to all and, you know, promote those themes.
I think especially for London, the art scene is so international, and there's so many people that come from outside who are really contributing to it. So, like, even Dorothy Bone, like, she is one of the founders of the Photographers' Gallery, which is in Soho.
Mm-hmm. I think in 1971 that got set up, and obviously she comes from outside the UK and has contributed that, and that's now a flourishing institution with a lovely, lovely space. And to me, it's quite, it's really tragic that there's no amazing museum space for the Ben Urey collection. And well, I'm sure that in the future it's bound to become a reality. But so many other contributions have been made in terms of different collections, like the most important private collection of Italian artists in London, the Esteric Collection. Loads of other galleries bring in artists from all over the world, from Iceland at the Barbican now. Raven Row is a teeny tiny gallery in Spitalfields, not far off from where Ben Urey was founded, and that focuses on artists that haven't really got the recognition or the place to exhibit in the mainstream galleries from all over the world. And I don't know, I think London is very much a place that I, as an art enthusiast, want to be because it's so international and has that appeal.
And it seems as though it would be insane to be involved in the art world and not to support the idea of internationalism. I'm just wondering if there is any genuine friction between the issues of immigration and all those sorts of things that we've seen recently, you know, the pulling away of the country to some degree from its European neighbours, and the art world, or does the art world just carry blithely on and not have any idea of any of that going on?
Well, I think in terms of, things are definitely made more difficult by Brexit.
Such as?
I work part-time for a company that stages public art, big public art events, like Lumiere London, the Light Festival that took place in January. And the artists that we engage for that are very much, you know, their fees and their materials and their, basically their freedom of movement is very important to that occurring. But it is very true that the UK is very London focused, and it does benefit London, the fact that there is freedom of movement, and perhaps it is important to diversify to the rest of the nation in order for people to get behind that idea of people coming in and contributing and making positive, exciting contributions to where they are. And of course, there's places outside of London, Tate, I guess Liverpool and St Ives, but in general, it is London. There's this bubble of excitement, which perhaps you don't experience when you're not here.
So in a way, any kind of positivity that you're expressing about the idea of people coming and going is preaching to the choir, if it's a London audience that's coming to the exhibition. Really, it's outreach to the rest of the country. And that's very widely assuming that the rest of the country has some sort of problem with immigration. I know that not everybody does. But they've got a different story to tell in different parts of the country.
I think we've always been very, we've always adopted different cultures, different countries' traditions or food or art. We've always enjoyed that cultural exchange, if you like, with a wide audience. And I think that's really still reflected some of the issues that were raised regarding immigration. It wasn't keep your art. there's always been a celebration about what other people can show you and what they can bring to your life to enrich it. And I've struggled to find many people that wouldn't enjoy, you know, a Picasso or a Auerbach, you know, or a Degas or anything like that.
Coming over here, taking jobs off our 1935 photographers.
Yeah, exactly.
Should we head downstairs and look at a much less happy version of London? Yeah, that's a nice way to advertise, isn't it? A little description as we go down, by the way, because this, I've got to say, this is a very well-kept gallery. You would expect a gallery to be well-kept. Very light. I think pastel would be damning the place. But very, very light in tone.
But accessible.
Bright, airy.
Intimidating.
Somebody off stage is saying accessible and not intimidating.
Oh, okay.
That's quite right. And through we come into, well, what would this have been before? This is reminding me of something. I mean, is this just basically a two-story townhouse that's been converted?
It's basically a house, yeah. Yeah.
It's got those domestic dimensions. I guess we're in the probably in the dining room now.
Perhaps, I don't know, I'm not sure.
Around the walls we have stuff from the 60s.
Yeah, that's Neil Libert. So he's the youngest photographer in the show. And was he born in Manchester?
Yes,
I think so, yeah. So he's a Brit, but he went to New York.
Yes.
And so this part of the exhibition is about him coming to New York in the 60s and viewing the city with his kind of foreign eyes. Yeah, there's loads of shots of, I guess, what you would expect from fabulous New York in the 60s.
The Upper East Side to Harlem and the tensions that he encountered. Yeah, he's got a great... I mean, this 42nd Street is a great shot. You can see very affluent woman walking by, a man in a car staring at her. But what you look in the background, you can see Voodoo Woman is showing at the cinema, and this sort of composition of the woman who's out of focus but quite high up, and the man in the car quite low, and it's sort of a comment on status, and this woman, the Voodoo Woman, you know, sort of he's entranced by her walking along.
So I don't know. In fairness, okay, so the chap in the car is wearing dark glasses, so he could be looking at anything. In fact, he could be looking at the photographer, thinking, "Why is that bloke taking a photograph of me?" But what I really like, what I really like about this, and the picture next to it, which shows maybe he's a chauffeur, maybe he's one of those guys in the parking lot who opens the door and takes the car, yeah. But he's a bit long in the tooth to be doing that job, really.
Yeah.
And the photograph's been taken in the foreground is somebody who's clearly got money, but they're out of focus, and it's actually the guy holding on expectantly to the handle of the car door, ready to open it for her, who's in focus.
Yeah.
He's clearly not expecting that anybody's looking to him. And it's the same with the woman in the street there. Yeah. It's the person who would ordinarily be focused on who's out of focus.
Yeah, that's a theme that he does quite a lot in his work.
Really nicely juxtaposed in that sense, really nicely hung together. And this, you're right, kind of mysterious, affluent woman not in focus.
This is also a very interesting one. So it's called Harlem Race Riots.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is that he doesn't really focus on, you know, the violence or anything. It's really a very simple photograph of a young black boy who's playing, it looks like a sort of toy gun or something, and he's standing in front of the police officer. And
he's holding his real gun.
Who's about to, you know, grab his truncheon, I think, and you can see the holster with the gun and his holster there. But the focus is the boy's looking at him, but the police officer's looking off. And it's just quite a neat moment that he's captured.
It's so poignant right now as well. When I first saw this, I was like, how is this hung here at this time?
Yeah.
It's kind of incredible because this was taken in 1964. And I guess Neil Libert was very, almost brave, kind of the way that he would take his shots, not afraid of what the violence might be. He also documented the Brixton riots in 1981. So that's what he's known for in the UK, for taking those documentary photographs.
I wonder whether they'd fit in here, because it seems to me that a subtitle for this collection could be The Gaze, G-A-Z-E. A lot of this is to do with capturing people looking unawares. Should we move into the area here? This is an eggshell blue room dedicated to Dorothy Boehm from upstairs.
Yeah, so Dorothy Boehm went to Paris, and she moved to London, or to the UK first, coming from Vienna or...
East Prussia, now Kaliningrad.
Yeah.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Where she was trained as a photographer, I think, and then she came to London.
Yeah. She was sent by her parents to Sussex and then trained as a photographer
in Manchester and then eventually settled in London. And then when she visited Paris in 1947, she was really struck by the city and its inhabitants. So yeah, we have a range of... we have quite an interesting one here with the local people in the street queuing up at the newsstand. And again, none of them are aware of her presence. They're all looking off. And it's also quite an interesting one in terms of what are they looking at? Probably the headlines is the only thing they could probably see, the large print. Mm. And just, you know, how different, how this scene you wouldn't see today. You know, our media sources are so different, the way we gather information. And it's just quite an interesting, different generations, different dynamics of people.
I guess now, if it was 1947 transformed into the
20th
century, it's just, breaking news, someone shared something on Facebook, yeah. Something awful, Mark is safe, you know, whatever. But honestly, like, this is probably how these people were reading about, I don't know, horrific things that were happening in 1947.
I think a contemporary portrait would show those five people, four of them would be looking at their mobile phones,
exactly.
Reading the news, and the fifth would be running into the street chasing after a Pokemon Go character.
that seems appropriate, yeah.
It's remarkable, actually, when we were looking at Liberat, it struck me that some of his photographs, it looked as though the people were sort of half aware in some of the shots of the photographer being there. You were kind of conscious of there being space off stage that the photographer inhabited, whereas, as you say, Bomb seems to be... Well, if you were to tell me that she was in one of those camouflage shelters covered in fake leaves, I would believe you. It's like nobody's aware that there's anybody else in the street. I wonder how she achieved that. Do we know anything about what she... Well, she must have been here.
Yes, she has been in, but
what does she look like?
She
ancient,
agile, and actually very, very actively, you know, still engaged in photography, still taking photos.
Sure, but my point is she a noticeable figure?
She's just quite a inconspicuous lady, really.
Inconspicuous.
Yeah, I'd
right.
say.
Well, maybe that's how she gets
you
her.
Wouldn't, you know, she's not. Yeah,
I think in a lot of these, it seems that overall these photographs are less focused on people and much more kind of formally aware of shadows, different ways that the light is falling, boulevards along the Seine, bridges, really a documentary of the urban fabric of the architecture of Paris in that time. So in a way, perhaps she didn't have to surprise people in the same way because she was kind of taking people more from a distance.
I suppose it must be the case that... am I about to say something stupid here? Yes, probably, but let's give it a go anyway. It seems to me that somebody photographing Paris in the 50s needn't necessarily expect that the viewer of the photographs is familiar with what Paris looks like. You know, you can surprise them with the exoticness of it. Maybe Paris is a bad example, I'm not sure.
No, I don't think it is at all. I think definitely for a UK audience, in terms of Paris in the war as well, must have been very closed off. And
yeah, you wouldn't have been holidaying there, would you?
Well, yeah, and what Paris looks like after the war in comparison to what London looks like after the war, you know, there's parallels, and I think that must have been a very kind of pertinent comparison for people to see those shots and be like, okay, this is, you know, a counterpart European city, really not very far away. And, I mean, people look at Paris now as well and see what's happening and people compare and contrast and, you know, are the anxieties that surround Paris right now, are they relevant in London? And, yeah, I think there's always that link between the two cities.
Well, speaking of our city, I can see through the portal here into... Well, this would have been a bit of a... I'm struck, if this was somebody's house, where did they get the light from? This must have been a very pokey... I think it's a lot better light.
No windows,
No windows. No. None of those skylights that look up to the pavement where you can see out people's trousers.
We really are in the basement, aren't we? So we're under exactly.
Yeah,
so.
That's it.
Yeah.
Well, pictures of ruins and damage all around us. This is... Now I'm going to throw myself at this person's name. You've said it a few times. I should be able to do this. Wolf Szyszczycki. Szyszczycki.
Szyszczycki?
Sorry, Wolf. Well, the most striking image, first of all, on the left here is St. Paul's Cathedral. And it's seen through what looks to be the ruins of a building. We're looking, I think, through a window frame that's just about survived. It looks as though the building around it has pretty much been reduced to rubble. And the panes of glass have all been shattered, and the frame within the opening for the window hangs at a funny angle. Through it, we see St. Paul's Cathedral still standing.
Yeah, so St. Paul's built after, rebuilt after the Great Fire of London, standing tall after what they call the Second Great Fire of London, one of the most destructive episodes in the Blitz in London. Famously, Winston Churchill insisted that St. Paul's must be saved at all costs, so surrounding buildings were pretty much sacrificed so that all the...
Yeah, they made a fire break, didn't they?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Mm. So this is very much a tribute shot, which I had never seen before. And we were saying earlier, the famous shot of St. Paul's standing tall...
amongst the smoke.
Yeah, it's the dome kind of appearing out of this fog of smoke. And this is just, to me, was an entirely new image taken from on the ground through these, I guess it's steel metal...
Yeah, we've got like a frame within a frame, through the grate.
Yeah, formally really interesting as well. The barriers, the pillars of this framework of a window, kind of going along the pillars of St. Paul's.
It's very much protecting it, just as Churchill wanted it.
Do not destroy.
Yeah.
There is a quality to that picture that makes me feel as though that is utterly modern, and I can't quite place it. I mean, there's nothing about the subject that particularly suggests that. There's something about, though, the quality of the photograph that seems so contemporary. Maybe it's the absence of signifiers of it being a different time that lets you imagine it's now.
Yeah.
And it looks as though also it's a photograph that you wouldn't probably have wanted released at the time. The sort of victorious shot, I suppose, the miraculous survival picture with the smoke all around, but St. Paul's still standing.
I think
much more celebratory. This one, this suggests this something else.
At what cost, exactly? Mm-hmm. I think the famous image is, you know, very kind of... It's become a bit of a cliche whenever an anniversary comes around of the Blitz or of a Second World War, then that kind of pops up. And this is grounds it more, quite literally, like from the ground. This is what it looked like after the Blitz. To me, it's amazing. London was destroyed, and so much of the buildings that have gone up after the war wouldn't have been there if it hadn't been for the Blitz, and especially in the city.
Mm. Well, perhaps that brings us on, I'm not sure, Katie, to the picture just to the right here.
Yeah, we've got a main road, and your eye line sort of follows from the bottom all the way to the top, and you can see Tower Bridge in the distance, but just going along the road you have bombed houses, completely destroyed, and as your eye follows up, houses start to reappear again, and in the distance the iconic London that you know even today is still there, still remains.
Yeah, there's the monument, there's St. Paul's, Tower Bridge. But yeah, these plots in the foreground, it's like one of the architectural digs on Saturday afternoon TV.
Yeah.
A set of low
time
walls.
Time tunes spin in.
I've never seen anything quite like that before. And there's a particular, you can see there's a particular junction where the bombing must have stopped, or the fire must have petered out.
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me of a sort of a game that, you know, a computer game that people play today, that you can, you know, it's so well mapped out because it's, you know, gridded, and you can really get a sense of, right, that part's destroyed, but that bit still going, still
alive.
It
used to be organised and orderly, and now it's back to square one.
Oh, so this is up some... this says it's the view from St. Paul's Cathedral, so that tower in the distance, I was mistaken there. So this is from St. Paul's Cathedral, so that is the fire break just there.
Yes.
Let's keep going. I'm fascinated by these images.
There's the wax.
What's this? Now, this has warranted not only a photograph, but also a display cabinet with some documents here. What's this all about? The picture, I should say, is... It looks like the side of a tube station. It's got that familiar architecture in the arches. But the banner being shown in this photograph outside the building says, "War in Wax, the world's most modern waxworks. The horrors of the German concentration camps, all in lifelike and life-size figures, over 100 figures." Ye gads, really?
Yeah. I mean, it's really shocking to think that this was an acceptable, Madame Tussauds horror show. It must have, you know, it's
London dungeon, or that kind of, it gives that kind of feel of, like a tourist attraction.
Yeah.
And these flyers, it's just baffling, really. Children's section.
Children's section?
Exactly. War in Wax. A pamphlet advertising, I guess, how kids can learn about
the horrors of what was happening at the time. And this is pamphlet is 1944, 1945. It's a perfect example, I guess, of a photograph bearing witness to something that I guess we can all kind of collectively forget or deny or, I don't know.
Bit of information here next to the photograph says, Wolf Suschitzky recalls photographing the war in wax in Oxford Street towards the end of the Second World War. Quote, this is the only obscene photograph that I've ever taken. I was too revolted to go in to investigate. End quote. A mere glance at the list of dioramas in the pamphlet below is sufficient to understand Suschitzky's revulsion. They are called things like the sealed wagon, tree hanging, and stamping to death, representing but a sample of the extraordinary waxworks that were displayed. That is extraordinary. Mm. Words fail me.
Mm.
I can't.
And the price as well. You know that you can pay extra as well and see Churchill and Roosevelt. You know, it's just bizarre that it even existed. And you think about Oxford Street today. I mean, it's hard to even correlate that would even be there.
It's that kind of thing where you wonder. Well, people are in the moment and they hear about these things and it just takes a while for things to sink in. Mm. So the idea that this was, you know, informative and even interesting or to some extent sensational,
yeah,
5, 10, 20, however many years later is completely, you know, dumbfounding the fact that we would do that. But I guess there's things that would that happen now where we delve into them and we, I don't know, show things on television where I guess later you might be like, well, that was kind of crazy that we considered that in that moment the way that we did. And it takes a bit of distance to kind of really see the scale of how horrible the things have been.
Well, I sort of felt it went the other way. I mean, I've got a particular museum in my mind that's opened not very long ago, which takes grisly deaths from yesteryear and puts them on display. And I'm not going to give them the publicity. Regular listeners to the show will know exactly what I'm talking about. But the fact that in 1945 there would have been artists knocking together wax models of Holocaust victims seems, I think my tiny brain can't quite cope with the thought there. I'm going to let that percolate for a while, I think. And focus instead on the much more celebratory picture on the right here. And I can't get enough of these sorts of picture. Mm-hmm. VE Day, this is in Coventry Street, Piccadilly Circus, 1945. Right at the middle of it, we have a guy playing an accordion that may itself have been salvaged. It looks like it's just about to fall to pieces, but he's putting together a song. Everyone's clearly mid-verse, and they look absolutely exhausted, but they've got through it.
Yeah, they're not all happy expressions, are they? They're actually quite, you're right, they look absolutely exhausted.
I wonder what he's playing. Maybe it's a dirge or a lament or something.
It's a big crowd of people, and this one I think is really interesting as well, looking at Trafalgar Square from behind the head of one of the lion sculptures. Big crowd demonstrating in the way that we now see demonstrations, people taking to the streets, but they were actually demonstrating for the opening of a second front against Germany in 1942. So, yeah, really documenting history as it was unfolding.
Astonishing. Yeah. So this is a crowd of people who are asking for more war, please.
Yeah.
Huh.
I know. The reversal couldn't be more pertinent, really.
I mean, when you first look at it, you think it's VE Day, don't you, or celebration, it's a mass group of people wanting more, and there's children and, you know, very young people and soldiers as well, and, you know, women, and it's quite a mix of people who are there.
It makes me realise that if you thought you had a secure business in the hat trade, how wrong you are. How times have changed.
Yeah, exactly.
I think we should bring them back. Hats are great.
I think so as well. You need them in this country. Actually, hats, what non-hat wearers don't realise is you don't need all the extra layers that you take out with you to deal with all sorts of different weather. Just take a decent hat. It actually does a lot of that work.
Just the ears are warm. And
that's it.
One more fabulous hat here. Actually, two. Three fabulous hats, the woman wearing that, I guess, what would you call it? Flowery decoration.
half beret. I don't know. It's sort of a well, it's off a, the side.
It's a cake. It's a cake.
It's pretty much, yeah.
But she looks very glamorous. The fur, shawl, even the way she's sort of pointing her toe towards...
She's aware of the photo.
She's very aware of the photographer.
She's posing.
And in fact, if you compare the feet, you know, the woman is pointing, looking very glamorous, but the gentleman she's with, is getting his shoes shined.
Well, so he can do exactly the same thing, no doubt.
And it's interesting that those, the two, the you know, the well-dressed couple are looking at the camera, but the man who is anonymous, we have just his back and know that his only role is to shine this man's shoes, is you know, hidden to us. We don't see his face, and it's that caption, that snapshot of status symbol and who these people are and what they're doing in that moment.
Yeah, so the division that Suschitzky encountered when he came to London, so this is in 1936, I guess is quite similar to what Neil Libert was documenting in New York. Very obvious contrast between wealth and social class.
Mm. We've started to see a bit of that coming back, haven't we?
Well, maybe
it's
not
just
sure
me.
It ever went away.
Well, no, but the number of homeless people you see on the street is
incredible.
Certainly increasing, for example.
I don't know whether it's something that once you know that those numbers are increasing, you start to notice more, but I've felt that since I've moved to London, I've been noticing it more and more and more. People that on the street where you... Honestly, they don't look like they've been on the street for very long, and they really don't seem, you know, they just look like backpackers who are just going to, you know, go home. Like, but really, yeah, young people and more in London. This photograph taken in the wake of the Wall Street crash, you know, does history repeat itself? Does it, like, come back in a different way? I really hope this is not the 21st century's 30s with 40s to follow. That would not be good.
No, but the fashion will be good.
Fashion will be excellent.
Well, what is lovely about this photograph is that the fashion has obviously changed so much, but in the background, Cambridge Circus, you can still see, you know, the roads, the buildings, they still look very much the same now as they did then. And I think that's quite a nice way to sort of think about, you know, all these people are gone and their photos are of them in that moment are there, but the place, the location, the city is the constant, and that's throughout all of these.
Yeah.
Should we end on sheep?
Oh. I thought you'd never ask. End on sheep. Oh yes, we're in Hyde Park.
I think this one is looks the most like this could be today as well, like.
And more broadly, rather than just the date being flexible, this could be any part of rural England.
The UK, yeah, exactly. And for foreigners, I think the UK and especially outside of London, you know, like it's a garden and the landscapes are beautiful. And this to me is very reminiscent. Yeah, maybe Cornwall, like sheep or I don't know. A very romantic picture. I think a very light tone in this context of other photographs.
Yeah.
Throughout the 1920s, this is a London fact, people. Throughout the 1920s and 1930s until the outbreak of the Second World War, the Aberdeen-based shepherd, George Donald, would bring his flock of sheep down to London to graze in Hyde Park, helping to keep its grass at a manageable length. That makes no sense whatsoever, does it? Aberdeen?
You have to have your grass at the right length.
Well, I don't mind the grass being at the right length, but surely they could have found some sheep that were closer than that.
They need to be.
Why would he do that?
No, who knows? Who knows?
Do you think he kept taking them back and forth?
I would hope that they could stay there for quite a long time.
You think so? And then
Stubborn sheep.
We demand
only Hyde Park grass for us, yeah.
But that sounds like they were on some sort of rotation system. What on earth's going on? I need to find out more about
this. There must be some very comical stories of people bumping into sheep or something.
Yeah, and then why do you think they stopped it during the war? I mean, maybe because people would nick the sheep or something, but maybe blackouts, they'd trip over the sheep? Or
yeah, exactly, unless they were painting them with white paint. And
no, then they'd be a target for the bombers.
Ah, yes.
a moving one as well. So yeah.
I heard a wonderful, this is, since we're talking a little bit about bombing London, I heard a wonderful story about somebody during the war. So this is connected with the Battle of Britain, and we know that the fighters were going over there, and the future of the country hinged on the success of our RAF.
Mm.
And a farmer in the country set up a fake landing strip. So a big field, you know, designed it to look, put a few lights on it, and then every night he would go and get his tractor and he'd pull a fake plane. I think he attached wooden wings or something like that, and lights, and he'd just drive his tractor up and down to give the impression that this was a working airstrip.
Yeah.
So he ran the risk of being bombed every night on his tractor.
Yeah. There were quite a lot of fake military bases, inflatable tanks, you know, planes made of just wood laid out so that from an aerial viewpoint it would just look like we had bases all over. And it was quite ingenious, the things that people thought up to fool the enemy.
Well, I think they should have kept the sheep for that reason then. No, this is Aberdeenshire, you're in the wrong place. Luftwaffe.
But the children that come and visit absolutely love this particular photograph because it's just that surprise of Hyde Park, my local park or a park I've been to, and it had sheep on it, you know, and that's one of the beauties of using that collection and getting that engagement.
So gradually drawing towards the end of the show, I guess, your work as learning and engagement and education, on that side of things, are you dealing mainly with small people?
Well, it's primary and secondary.
Children, I mean, not just small people.
It's all ages. It's primary and secondary school sessions that we run and digital resources we create for them. But we also have an extensive adult learning program. So we invite people to come along for our life drawing classes, iPad art. We also set up community partnerships. And we have a fantastic wellbeing program, which works with local residential homes and looks into, you know, further research and what we can do to improve people's lives through art, basically. So unfortunately, Unseen will finish on the 28th of August, but we will have a new exhibition which will be opening in September. It's called Yalta 1945, and it's by Vitaly Koma and Alexander Melamed. It's an installation. It's going to be like 31 different panels. The two of them combined created something called SOTS Arts. So imagine pop art, which was a celebration of commercialism. This is actually a criticism of Soviet propaganda and ideology that was prominent during their time in Russia. And they moved to America, and they were never officially considered never officially allowed to showcase their art in galleries in Russia. It was always cafes or wherever they could find a space. And, you know, they were basically pushed out, you know, they weren't allowed to showcase their materials. So
is it sort of satirical in tone?
Very much, yeah, very much satirical, sort of socialist realism. It's going to be a really interesting change from Unseen, but it's definitely worthwhile to come and have a look at, because it's going to be very, political. We're going political with our art and making a statement, and I think that's what these two are all about.
Oh, what's on the horizon for art, Gina?
So Artuna is going to have a show in New York soon, and an online curation is going up as well. On the website right now is Andy Holden, which is an artist that works with cartoons, and the show that will follow will also be about cartoons. So it's about the influence that the cartoon world has had on contemporary artists and the way that a lot of cartoons are kind of infiltrating the art world. There's a lot of the cartoon is very kind of happening right now for lots of different artists who feel that blending lower art with kind of more high art is great for getting people excited about contemporary art. So that's going to be in New York in Chelsea in a gallery, physically mounted, but also on the website.
And of course, you're going to be writing about this exhibition.
Yeah, that's the plan. That this is going to be featured in a series called Best Kept Secrets. So there's been 12 so far, and then Ben Muir is definitely going to be a great addition to the series. Very much a collection that is a secret because it doesn't, you know, it doesn't benefit from the space that it really deserves. And even though this exhibition shows that it's very worth visiting and you make great use of the space that you do have,
Yeah, I very much hope that in the future new exposure and new projects will lead to a permanent venue.
Yeah, what's the plan? I'd love to. I mean, if this were 12 times the size, then I'd lap it up. It's fantastic.
Well, you can help us out. You know, you can become a friend of Ben Uri. You can help with fundraising. You can just generally spread the word that we're here. Go on our website, www.benuri.org.uk. And, yes, Facebook, social media, Twitter, Instagram, anything that you can do to just promote us, because it would be fantastic to have that permanent venue.
Yeah, I think people don't know, but the canvases, like you were saying, Auerbach, Soutine, Chagall, George Grosz, just all these kind of names that as an art lover excite me, and then to think that they're all stored away in storage somewhere is sad.
Let's
get them on some walls. Yeah.
We need to get them out and on display.
And if you've got a dining room that you don't mind being painted pastel and converted, then I'm sure a subsidiary gallery license could be operated. Not really, no, that's not meeting with approval. So we've got the Ben Uri website, and ArtTuner can be found at, no surprises,
ArtTuner.com.
Ava Mack, Katie Harris, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
My heart aches for some far-off place, no one could have.
And that's all for this week. My thanks for this week to Katie Harris and Ava Mack. Thanks to Nico Epstein, Katie Barron and Bernie Barclay. Theme and incidental music was by Songs from the Howling Sea. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.